Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Betsy Fentress, and we are really happy to have Kate Milligan on the show with us. We're going to be talking all about her own project that is being taken, that has taken the internet by storm since 2019, One Girl Revolution. And it's a social platform that highlights the stories of everyday women who are changing the world through their lives. Thanks for taking time to join us today, Kate.
Thank you so much for having me, Betsy. I'm so excited to be here.
So you've worn several hats and currently are still one of the biggest names in the PR world, but simultaneously, you've been able to build One Girl Revolution. Can you tell us where this idea came from?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for that. I don't know if I'm one of the biggest names in PR, but I sure have worked hard to, I've worked really, really hard in my PR career. But I started One Girl Revolution at the end of 2018, going into 2019. And it was right after I had been living in DC for 7 years and decided to move back to Detroit. And while I was in DC, I was really frustrated by the fact that women's voices and their stories weren't often told in the media. And kind of as a fun side project with all of my like PR work that I was doing, I would pitch interesting or inspiring stories that I would find on the internet. I would be like, oh, here's a cool story of somebody doing something innovative or someone making some sort of social impact. And every time I would pitch those stories, Betsy, and again, they were not paying clients. It was just a fun side project because I would talk about how these stories deserve to be heard, right? These women and these girls, their stories deserve to be heard, but most of the time they wouldn't be covered because it wasn't divisive or it wasn't politicized. You know, every time we look at the media, everything, at least from my perspective, everything with regards to women and girls is divisive or politicizes their stories, or people or media outlets try to put women and girls in a box. And we can all relate to that because we also experience that every single day where people put us in boxes or say like, oh, I think that you're this way because of your faith or your background or your beliefs. And I wanted to really pull back the curtain and say, no, here is an opportunity for women and girls to share their stories in the way that they want. Let's focus on our commonality as women and girls and really embrace the fact that we have the power to change the world through our lives. And so that's how the name One Girl Revolution came about, because I truly believe that every single woman and girl has a purpose. Each and every one of us has value, and that we each hold the power to change the world through our lives.
Well, I agree with that. I have a question, though, because you were in D.C. and you talk about how, you know, these stories weren't getting told. Well, what about all of the, you know, the women's magazines like Vogue or Glamour? I mean, were they telling these stories, or did you feel like in particular in the nation's capital, it was just sort of a man's world? And I mean, because I feel like there have been stories that have been told, but something was really bothering you about the way in which they were told or being ignored. Can you elaborate a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think for me, it was so concentrated, right? Like you said, in DC, I'm drinking through a fire hose of media, right? Every single day in, right, day out, and especially working in PR, you never had an off switch. You were constantly like jumping from one thing to another. And so I saw it in such a concentrated way. I do think that it is a problem worldwide, not just nationwide, that there are, of course, instances where some of these stories may get some media coverage. And many of the women that we have on the podcast, many of them have never told their stories before because they've never been given an outlet. Or they've had 30 seconds in a news clip to tell their story. And what's really cool to me about the media or the form of media being a podcast is it really is this opportunity to share your story in the way that you want. And it's a longer form, right? I'm not as long as some of the podcasts. I'm so inspired by the people that go on for 3 hours, but I try to keep it short and sweet, but it really is this space where I'm only asking questions to help these women curate their stories, but it really is a space for them to talk about the things that matter to them. And I'm not trying to tell their story in a way that I want to tell it. I'm trying to just create the space for them to tell their stories. So I think that's what makes One Girl Revolution unique.
Well, in addition to your podcast, you've also done a couple of documentaries. They're really, really amazing. And one of them is called The Girl Inside. It's about Dr. Laura Biagi, who goes into Cook County Jail and runs a class, and she talks about storytelling as a healing art. Tell us about how you got access to go inside a correctional facility. And I was just blown away by the sweetness of the women. I mean, I couldn't imagine what they did to, you know, get themselves in this really tough position, because they all just seemed like somebody's mom or somebody's grandma that, you know, probably had one bad move that tanked them.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Betsy, and I've learned so much. So I'll tell you the story of the girl inside, but I've learned so much through that experience of telling that story through the documentary, The Girl Inside. But also, women and girls are the fastest growing population in jail and prison, and we don't often hear about that. Since the 80s, it's gone up 700%, which is crazy to me. Why is that? And what's really interesting about women and girls specifically is there is almost always another motivating factor. So in differentiation, men will just have a bad day and they'll go rob a bank, for instance, you know, and women, there's almost always some other motivating factor. So they're trying to feed their kids. They're struggling to pay rent. They're trying to take care of themselves. They can't get a job. They, you know, recidivism rates ending back up in jail and prison is because they just can't get their feet back on the ground. And so women are just fascinating in general to me. You know, I think that women are so fascinating because we're so multifaceted. But even in the stories of incarcerated women or formerly incarcerated women, they have stories to tell. And to me, with the girl inside, it was so important to just tell their stories, not why they did what they did or what they did to end up in jail or prison. That wasn't important to me. What was important to me is, who are you as a person?
Right.
If we truly believe in the dignity of every single person, their lives matter. And so even if they're behind the walls of Cook County, their lives matter, and they have a purpose, and they have the power to change the world, right? The One Girl Revolution motto. And so I had heard about the story, to answer a question about how it came about. I had heard the story of Dr. Laura Biagi, and I literally cold emailed her and said, hey, can I meet with you? I'll drive. I was in Detroit at the time. I still live in Detroit, but at the time I was in Detroit, drove down to Chicago, met with her. She was like, I'm in, let's do it. I called my friend Rob Kazmark, who runs Behold, a studio in Chicago. And I said, Rob, I have this story. I think that it's right up your alley. Would you do this with me? And he was like, if you can get clearance to go into jail, yeah, we'll do it. It took me 9 months, Betsy, to get clearance. I talked to everybody from the sheriff to the PR department to the guards to anybody you could think of. We had to clear every single item that we were bringing in with us. So everything from the number of pieces of paper to pens to everything, because you're going into this locked down situation. And even on the day of, we didn't know exactly who was going to be in the room. We knew that there were a couple of women that had been Dr. Biagi's former students that were willing to be filmed and willing to be a part of this. But what ended up happening in that one day, so it was one day us recreating her class and then creating this opportunity for these women to do their performances and share their monologues. And it's only 10 minutes. I always tell people it's such a short
watch. It's
on YouTube, and it's so powerful. So anytime I have a bad day, I'm like, let me turn on The Girl Inside, because these women are so incredible. Like what you said, they're so inspiring, and they've come through hell and back. You know, they share the stories of things that they've gone through, but also when they were little girls, before trauma happened, before things that etched away at who they were created to be, they went back to that little girl, right? So it's the girl inside of Cook County Jail, but the girl inside in each of every one of them. And it's, to me, it was such an eye-opening experience for me, because it reminded me of when I was a little girl, right? Before difficult things happen, before death or hardship or traumas that we've all experienced, who was I created to be? Let me go back to that little girl. Let me go back and remember who she was. What were her hopes and dreams? And there are facets of that that we want to carry with us throughout our whole lives. And so it changed my life, Betsy, that day. That documentary changed my life. And the coolest part is I'm still in touch with Dr. Biagi. And one of the women is actually, that I know of, is out. So she, her and I have stayed in touch. So Miss Lili, who's amazing. And yeah, it's such a great documentary. So I encourage everybody to watch it.
I do too, and I love the journaling that they do, where they try to have the correct and the true voice about who they are come out. And which brings me to your story. You grew up, you ended up having something called Job's syndrome, and it, you know, you had some tough times. And how did that grit and resilience and suffering play into you starting One Girl Revolution?
Yeah, it's such a big part in retrospect. But when I started One Girl Revolution, I never connected my own story to it. And I think that's what's so interesting to me about all of the stories and women and girls that I'm highlighting. Many of them just see a need in their community and they start something. But I always try to get them to remember, like, what were the things in your life that like got you on this path? Or is there some connecting point? Because I think we all do have those things, right? Why do you care? Why do you believe what you believe? Why are the things that you're really passionate about? Why are those the things that you're passionate about? And we need to take moments to reflect. And so for me, it was after that, the girl inside and doing the podcast for a little while, I started reflecting on my own story. And like you said, I was born with Job syndrome. It's named after Job in the Old Testament, who, as we know, suffered greatly. So people with Job syndrome, I was one of 25 cases. My youngest sister also has it. So we were two of 25 cases in the entire world when we were diagnosed as little kids. And today there are only 250 documented cases. So they don't really know how to deal with it. They don't really know how, to treat it. But thankfully, we had the incredible mama that we did who did all kinds of amazing holistic things and cut things out of our food, all the things that are now being talked about in the world, where it's like cut the dyes out of food and different things. And so she really was able to heal us. But my story, I had terrible eczema as a little kid. I would itch my hair out, so I barely had any hair. My skin was completely raw. I had a little red face in all of my school pictures, just terrible, terrible suffering as a little kid in retrospect. And it's something that I would never hope for anybody, but I was this feisty, happy little kid. And when I went into school, like so many other people, because of the way that I looked, because of the things that I was experiencing, I started getting bullied. And I went from being this feisty, happy, opinionated little kid to not speaking at all in class. And even like my report cards reflected that. They were like, yeah, she's very insular, which was not me at all. So thankfully, my parents were very clued in and they were like, hey, what's going on? Let's help you find your voice again. So I ended up doing Irish dancing of all things, and it was before River Dance, before it became a thing. It was like this weird thing that I was doing, you know, or unique, very unique thing. And it was my magic feather, like from Dumbo. It was the thing that really helped me find my courage again, get my confidence back to be able to stand in front of class or raise my hand. And it seems like such a little thing, but to me, it was so life-changing, that experience, because I know what it feels like to be forgotten. I know what it feels like to be ignored and silenced and marginalized. And that's really, to me, my personal heart, my personal One Girl Revolution story is I never want another woman or girl to feel that way. I want them to see and know that they are valued, that they have purpose, and that they have the power to change the world through their life.
Well, your story and One Girl Revolution caught the attention of Kelly Clarkson. And you were on her show with a very special young woman named Ruby Kate Chitsey, founder of Three Wishes for Ruby's Residence. That's a beautiful story, and that clip is also on your website. But tell us about Ruby.
Gosh, Ruby is an angel, and I'm so grateful to know her. I found out about Ruby's story. So she's 17 now. I found out about her story when she was 11, maybe. And my mom was like my greatest source for finding stories. She would always just see some random thing on Facebook and share it with me, or she would see a local news story and she would send it to me. And now I get stories from all different types of people, even people that are like, hey, this person is in my neighborhood and they're doing this cool thing. So I love when people send me stories. But my mom had sent me Ruby Kate's story. And when Ruby was 10, she started granting wishes. Her mom was a nurse at a senior living facility, and Ruby started granting wishes to elderly people in the senior living facility. She would save up her money and she would go and grant wishes. And now it's become an organization. Her little initiative, her little project that she was doing years ago has now become this incredible worldwide organization called Three Wishes for Ruby's Residents. And so, yeah, it was so special. She's come to Michigan, I've been to Arkansas. We've been able to work together on multiple things. And so when Kelly Clarkson's show called and said, "Hey, we want to bring you out," and then simultaneously they were like, "We want Ruby Kate to come and share her story and talk about the impact of One Girl Revolution," it's one of the highlights of my life for sure.
Oh, it's a great story. And so your faith has played a component in this. You wrote about it in the Washington Post, and you talked about John Paul II's theology. Tell us how that has worked. I mean, it's inherent in what you say about that every person has dignity. But tell us about how that has informed what you do.
I have always been passionate about my faith, and my mom would always talk about how some people, she felt like some people have to work harder at their faith, or some people are just kind of born with this spark. And I was one of those kids that just always was born with this spark. I always was passionate about my faith. I've always had a devotion to the Blessed Mother. I love John Paul II. One of the highlights of my life was that I got to go see him at World Youth Day in 2002 in Toronto, and I'm still can't believe that happened. So I love Saint John Paul II, and I studied many of his writings when I was at Franciscan University of Steubenville. And that was really, I think, the moment when I started reading John Paul II and all of his writings. It really solidified my passion for human dignity and for the respect of the human person, and even more so the respect of women, right? And the power, the feminine genius. I was looking for that phrase, the feminine genius, which we hear about, but to me, it really is this power that women have and women hold. And John Paul II had such reverence for the Blessed Mother, of course, but also for women. And that's something that I wish that our culture would emulate. I wish that everyone in our culture would read John Paul II's writings about women and all of the incredible writings that he has about human dignity and the human person. I think that it would change people's lives. But for me, that's really the heart of why I do what I do every single day, why I care so deeply. And my hope is that me shining a light on the dignity of all of these incredible women and girls, and then them shining a light out to all of these other people that they're serving and the work that they're doing, that we can rise up a revolution. And that's truly what we've done.
Well, the article had quite a title. I'm a 30-year-old virgin. Excuse me. I'm a 32-year-old virgin, and I'm living the feminist dream. Did you get much pushback when that happened?
Girl, did I? The article, yeah, as you said, I'm a 32-year-old virgin living the feminist dream. And that article, what's interesting to me is it ran on Our Lady's birthday, September 8th. So that was a very powerful thing to me. And that was really a response to me seeing the Washington Post write multiple, they had ran a multiple articles from differing Christian perspectives that said how much their faith had held them back. And to me, my faith is so empowering to me. That's my experience. That's what I've seen. That's what I've experienced every single day. And to me, living my faith out in the way that I have, living out virtues, chastity, and so many others, that has given me freedom to actually be the person that I was created to be and become the person. I believe that we are becoming the person that we were created to be every single day. And so there was a freedom that came with that. And so that article, I almost never thought that it would run, Betsy. I just wrote it as a response, sent it to the Washington Post, and said, "Hey, I read these other two articles. Would you run these, or would you run this response? This is my perspective." And they did. They ran it with my photo, which was an interesting thing because I never had my photo run in a national publication,
You
and
were
so I
outed.
would. Yeah, I was outed. So anywhere I went in D.C., different times, people, and I got a lot of great positive feedback, but there was definitely an element of negativity that came with it, which was interesting because the majority of negative comments I got from that article was from men. And then the majority
Really?
of positive commentary that I got from that article was from women. And that was even from women that did not live in the same way or did not agree with me, if you want to say it that way, did not agree with my perspective. But they respected it. And that was so powerful to me that here I was, a 32-year-old woman, sharing my heart, sharing my own experience, sharing my life, my faith, and that women really respected that. And so I still get messages on Facebook, or randomly people will stumble upon it, and write me about it. But I'm so glad and grateful that I shared that. And I think it's such an important lesson to all of us. We are all called to be voices in different ways. I don't think that we have to constantly be commentating on every single thing, which I think the social media culture has really led us to, that like we think we have to comment on every little thing, but really to know where you feel called. And I felt so convicted to write that article, and the fruits of it have just been incredible. And I'm still so grateful that I had that opportunity.
And since you wrote that article, I believe you're now married, right?
I am. Yes. Yeah. I've been married for 3 years, which is amazing.
And how has that changed? Has that changed maybe some of the stories that you want to do that you maybe were maybe you were focused on single people, or and now you're looking at young married people, or what marriage has done, if in one girl revolution terms. Tell us about that.
I don't know that it's changed what types of stories that I want to tell. It definitely has changed my experiences, right? Like, I think that I used to be in a space where I felt like I could be more of a spokesperson for single women. And I do believe, even in, like, the church, I think, has a huge, they're missing an opportunity to really reach out to the single population, especially as we see people are getting married older. I was 37 when I got married, and there is just kind of a neglected group of people. And so I felt at that time when I was single that I really had an opportunity to speak for that demographic. And I think there are still ways that I can speak for that demographic and saying, hey, I was older when I got married. I still stand by everything that I've written, everything that I've said, everything that I've done. But then with regards to stories, I don't know that it's changed the types of stories that I want to tell, but I think that it's opened my eyes to other things. And one of the greatest fruits of marriage to me is that I have such a stable rock in my husband, and somebody who before, when I wrote that Washington Post article, it was me against the world in many ways. And thankfully, I come from a very supportive family, but it was a lot for me to step out on my own. And now to have a husband who is incredibly supportive, he stands by everything that I do, and loves the work that I do with One Girl Revolution, and stands by all the articles that I've written and everything. That is such a great fruit of marriage. And to me, and what I want to say to your listeners is, it's so worth waiting for. It's worth not rushing into something and finding somebody who is just going to be your rock and who is going to support you, because life is a journey, and so is marriage.
That's a really important message, and I'm so glad that you brought that up. I want to talk about a recent guest that you had on your podcast. She's a cancer survivor, inspirational speaker, author. Tell us about this special guest.
Yeah, so Leah Hunt is absolutely incredible. She founded Leah's Kids, and they do such great work supporting children who are going through cancer treatment. So, what many people, unless you've been through it, unless you've been through a cancer journey yourself, or you have somebody in your family, you don't realize all of the difficulties, right? It's already a strain on the kid. Of course, it's so difficult them going through chemotherapy, but also the siblings, the parents, the financial restrictions, just their schedules, right? They're just constantly going to the doctor. And these kids, many of them, and Leah is such a great example and such a beautiful voice, that she really grew up in a hospital. She shares that she was just constantly flying to one doctor to another, to going to all these things. And so you miss out on so many usual things that kids get, birthday parties or just celebrations, and just opportunities just to be kids, or as a family, just to do things that aren't medical, that you can just be a family and have fun together. And so Leah, when she was 18 years old, so she had gone through her cancer journey started when she was 2 years old. And then when she was 18, she decided, hey, I want to do something to help other people. And so Leah's Kids was born. They do incredible work to support families and kids who are going through cancer treatments, and they're just amazing.
I think you're drawn, I think we're all drawn to stories of resilience, wouldn't you say? And
Yes.
people that are, whether they're women who are still incarcerated and trying to figure it out, or whether people are helping people with cancer. Do you have any other documentaries in the works, or what other things are on the horizon for One Girl Revolution?
Betsy, I always have things in the works. I have so many tricks up my sleeve. No, there's so much work to be done. So first of all, we have a new podcast episode coming out every single week. So I encourage people to subscribe to our podcast. And those are unique, inspiring stories. We have a couple of different month-long campaigns coming up so people can subscribe and listen to those. And then documentary side, yeah, right now I'm working on fundraising to be able to tell more stories. We have two documentaries that are out on YouTube, but there's so many more to come. And I hope my dream, Betsy, is that we can take many of these stories that we've highlighted on the podcast and turn them into documentaries. Because as much as podcasts are so powerful and such a great opportunity to highlight these stories, there's something so unique and so powerful about seeing something. So that's what I think about even with The Girl Inside, right? Seeing, like pulling back the curtain and seeing these women, seeing their faces, seeing their tears, seeing them write. I want to be able to tell more stories in that way. And so really highlighting stories in different types of ways. I hope that we just continue to grow and evolve. But yeah, there's big things to come.
And do you have any aspirations to write a book?
That's definitely on the One Girl Revolution should have a book. Honestly,
yeah,
we should
I agree.
All have a book.
Kate Milligan, thank you so much for joining us. To learn more about Kate Milligan and all her work, go to onegirlrevolution.com. To learn more about Conversations with Consequences, please visit thecatholicassociation.org.
Thank you so much for having me, Betsy.
Great to have you.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
Well, we had some exciting news last week about Carlo Acutis's new canonization date, something we've been waiting on for a while. And here to discuss the first millennial saint is Catholic author and writer Sabrina Farisi. Welcome back to the show, Sabrina.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, we know that the firstborn U.S. Pope will canonize the first millennial saint in September. Tell us, how are you? How excited are you for this?
I'm super excited. And not only Carlos, but Pier Giorgio Frassati has been rescheduled for this new date in September. So, yeah.
What do you think it is about him that resonates with so many people?
I think there are two things. First of all, he lived in our times. He lived surrounded by technology. He had a laptop. He had a cell phone. He had a PlayStation, apparently. So I think that teenagers especially can relate to him. But even adults, we can relate to him because he lived with the things that we have today. And he learned how to live as a saint despite all this stuff. And even with it, he learned how to use it as a Catholic to evangelize. He's just really relatable.
I've heard that he had what he called a kit for becoming a saint. Is that true? And what was in the kit? I need that kit.
Sure. So basically, Carlo was a catechist, his mother was telling me, for about 4 to 5 years in his parish. He was like an assistant CCD teacher, teaching the kids confirmation, to get them ready for confirmation. So he came up with this kit, and he would teach this to his class. Can you imagine if you could say Carlo was your CCD teacher? I mean, amazing. No. The kit had 8 points. So, and they're all really good for all of us. So the first is we all have to desire holiness. We have to desire to become a saint. And if we don't have that desire, he said, you should pray for it. And that is a really good idea. Lord, give me that desire to be holy. The second one is to try to go to daily mass. And, you know, he lived in Italy. There's churches on every corner. He's in Milan. It might, you know, do your best. If you can go to daily mass, then go. Daily rosary. Now, his mother spoke in St. Patrick's Cathedral last month, and she said, you know, not everyone can go to daily mass for whatever reason. You might live in an area you don't have a church near you, but you can say the rosary every day. That is something that we can all do. Then he would say, try to read a little bit of the Bible every day. A few minutes, maybe 5 to 10 minutes. Read the Bible. He did Eucharistic adoration every day, either before or after mass. he would stay 10 or 15 minutes. And, you know, this is something he said that we should all try to do this if we can. He went to confession weekly. And so he said, if you can, go to confession weekly. If you can't go every week, try to go once a month, but try to make it a regular thing. He made sacrifices. So he was very concerned about people who had no one praying for them. So he would make sacrifices in reparation for sin and for the conversion of sinners. So for example, he loved snacks, like all of us do. And he would give up having a second piece of pie or give up having even one piece of pie, and he would offer that up, you know, for sinners. He was constantly making sacrifices for others. And the last thing, number eight, was ask your guardian angel to help you. Make your guardian angel your best friend. So he was always praying to his guardian angel. So this was his kit with the 8 points.
And Sabrina, you mentioned his mother.
Yes.
And I know that you've spoken with her. What have you learned about Carlos through his mother?
Oh, gosh. I've interviewed her many times. So on one hand, I learned that he was a normal kid. He had a lot of friends. He did all the normal things that Italian kids do and teenagers everywhere. He had dogs, he had cats, you know, he loved to play with his pets. He did a lot of sports, but he also had this intense spiritual side. And it was a spiritual side that didn't come from them. It wasn't from Antonia and her husband Andrea, because they were not practicing Catholics when he was born. He just received a special grace. And she said, you know, sometimes in the life of the church, there are people who are given a special grace from God. And she believes Carlo was one of them. And he led them back to church. So, you know, this doesn't happen all the time, but in their family, it did. At a very young age, he became very interested in matters of faith. He would ask questions. He wanted to go into churches all the time when they were walking. And this made a huge impression on Antonia and Andrea. And little by little, I mean, they really had the humility to let themselves be led back into the church by him. So I interviewed her actually last week, and she told me something new that I didn't know, that before he died, he had been reading a book about young saints. And he was actually interested to, he wanted to create an exhibit on young saints. And he never got a chance to do it. We know that he created an exhibit, which became a website, which was his website on Eucharistic miracles. So anyway, I just learned that he was very interested in young saints. He was a big fan of Pier Giorgio Frassati, who was going to be canonized on the same day as him. So that's also incredible. I didn't know that. So he was an amazing kid. He was an amazing kid. I feel like, you know, he's my nephew in heaven that I pray to all the time now.
Does the family have other children? Did Carlo have siblings?
So this is an interesting question. When he was alive, his mom and dad couldn't seem to have other kids. They tried, it didn't happen, so he was an only child. But after he died in 2006, his mother was thinking, well, we can't have kids, maybe we'll adopt. So she and her husband started the whole process to adopt, which in Italy takes like 4 to 5 years. It's terrible. I have my brother-in-law and sister-in-law live in Milano. They adopted. It took them about 4 years. So she was in the process of adopting when she had a dream with Carlo, and he said to her, you are going to become a mother again. And shortly after that dream, she discovered that she was expecting. And then she discovered that she was expecting twins.
Wow.
So she had twins 4 years to the day on the anniversary of Carlo's death. They were born 4 years to the day, and they are now almost 15.
That's amazing. And yeah, sounds like a miracle. Is that one of his miracles, or is it an unofficial
it is.
Miracle?
Yes, she thinks it is. I mean, I think she was well into her 40s.
Wow.
When she had the twins. So,
and what are their names, Sabrina? Are they boys or girls? Or
it's a boy and a girl, Francesca and Michele.
Tell us about some of the other miracles. My understanding is that one of them was 7 years to the day after his death, and that was the one that ultimately resulted in his beatification. But tell us about his miracles.
Sure. Well, one thing Antonia told me is that they get emails every day on the official Carlo Acutis website of miracles, of medical miracles with documentation. She says, we hear about miracles all the time. The miracle that led to his beatification was a little boy in Brazil named Mateus Viana. And at the time, he was 4 years old. This was 2013. And he had this anomaly with his pancreas, where it was malformed and it caused him to vomit every day. He couldn't really eat solid food. So it was horrible. His parents had been taking him to doctors, and the doctor said, well, we could do a surgery, but the surgery is very dangerous and he could die. So basically the parents were like, oh, you know, what do we do? Their parish priest named Father Tenorio had recently come back from Assisi. Somehow, I think he had met the family, the Acutis family, and they gave him a relic, a second class relic of, I guess, a piece of cloth that had touched Carlo's body. body before he died. And so Father Tenorio said, let's have a 9-day novena to Carlo in the parish. The parents of Mateos brought him in, and they had to carry him. He could barely walk because he was so weak. And they brought him up to the altar, and the father Tenorio said, what would you like to pray for? And he says, I want to pray to stop vomiting. So that same day, apparently he went home and he felt well. And he said, Mom and Dad, I want to eat something solid. I don't know what they gave him, but the parents were like really nervous. They're like, are you sure? And he said, yeah, I want to try. So he did, and he didn't vomit. And this happened every day for the next few days. And the parents finally said, all right, we've got to see what's going on. They brought him back to the doctors. They did an MRI and discovered that the pancreas was perfectly formed pancreas, and very different from the pancreas they had seen before with the MRI. So you could see the before and after, and he's fine now. He's a perfectly healthy Brazilian boy.
Well, just like you've said, a saint for our time, certainly for our children and our young people. And to learn more about Sabrina Farisi, make sure to check out her book on Blessed, soon to be Saint, Carlo Acutis, through Amazon, of course, or EWTNRC.com. So that's EWTN Religious Catalog is what that stands for, .com. Sabrina, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. And today I'm joined by our resident chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry, who was also the director for the Pontifical Mission Societies of the United States. And we are here to talk about two back-to-back feasts that everyone knows and loves. Two North African giants, St. Monica and her son, St. Augustine, on the August 27th and 28th. There's so much to say about these two people, Monsignor.
And they're getting a lot more attention this year because, as we know, on May 8th, we elected Pope Leo XIV, who in his first words said that he is a son of Augustine and an Augustinian. He really wanted to double down on that point. And because St. Augustine is the spiritual founder of the Augustinians, even though they were founded 800 years after St. Augustine died, they used his rule and they absolutely used his example and inspiration to be able to guide them in their own very rich spiritual and missionary charism. So St. Augustine, even though he's always been one of the biggest saints in the history of the church, he's become even bigger still. And Pope Leo, as we've been paying attention over these last several months, has been finishing most of his homilies with a reference to St. Augustine. He's trying to sort of open up the collected works of his spiritual father so that we're all going to be able to stand on St. Augustine's shoulders and see God and his action in the world far more clearly. And so let's get into the story. Some of our listeners are going to know it, but I just think it's one of the greatest and most inspiring in history. And whenever I'm in Rome, which now in my new position as the National Director of the Pontifical Mission Society, I have to be in Rome about 7 or 8 times a year. I'm always visiting the Church of St. Augustine, where St. Monica is buried, and taking to her the prayers I have for basically all the wandering sheep that I know of and that everybody else has entrusted to me, especially moms and grandmothers who are praying for their wayward sons and grandchildren. So St. Monica was born in Tagaste in North Africa, modern day Algeria, and she married young. Even though she was a Christian, she married a pagan whose name was Patricius or Patrick. He was a kind of tough husband, verbally abusive. Her mother-in-law is the paradigmatic mother-in-law that every young bride can't stand, who is constantly critical of her, cantankerous at every turn. So Monica, as a young woman, became a drunk. She used to escape to her basement in order to sort of escape from her troubles through some wine. But she herself eventually converted from that. She recovered some discipline. Her faith grew stronger, and boy, would she need it. She started to pray for the conversion of her husband and her mother-in-law, and it took her 17 years to do that. But at the end of her husband's life, he didn't know that he would be dying within a year, but eventually the grace of God penetrated. He became a baptized Catholic, and so did his mother-in-law, whose attitude changed to her daughter-in-law, etc. And so both of them were received into the church to Monica's great delight. But then Patricius died. And not only was that hard on Monica, who now became a widow, who was looking forward to celebrating her faith and living it together with her husband. But St. Augustine got all angry at God as to how God could have taken his father from this world. And so he, with teenage rebellion, even though he was brilliant, even though the family had really taken care of him, he started in his anger to turn against the God of his mother. And he, Augustine still hadn't been baptized yet. He was a catechumen, but he had come under his mother's spell and he had considered the Christian truths. But he now started shacking up with a girlfriend, and she conceived a child out of wedlock, a Deodatus, who would die later to Augustine's great mourning when Augustine was then in Italy. And he likewise started to attack the Christian faith, the faith of his mother, trying to use philosophy to do it. He went through this massive journey through what we would now call dualist philosophies, in which all spirit is good, all matter is bad. That wasn't ultimately satisfactory. He went through the Manichaean heresy. We'll save the gory details of that. But eventually started to sort of taunt his mom. He started to attack her faith and ridicule it. But Monica, with many tears, kept praying for his conversion. She was consoled once by a bishop who said that the object of so many tears surely will not perish. And she had had a dream in which, in the dream, God told her that your son will be with you. Later, when Augustine said, well, no, maybe that means you'll be with me. Maybe you'll lose your faith and come over to real reason with me. And Monica, even though her son was able to run circles around her intellectually with all his studies, she just simply said, no, 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 no. The dream said you would be with me, not me with you. And that stuck with Augustine. And so Augustine said, I'm getting out of here. And he wanted to go to Rome in order to advance his career. Monica said, I will come with you. They went to the port in Carthage. And Augustine abandoned his mom in that port. He said he needed to run an errand. He'd meet her. And in fact, he took off and he sailed across the seas, leaving his mom. Think about how cruel that is. In a big
it really
port,
is.
Abandoned. Monica, though, intrepidly got on a boat afterward, after she recognized she was betrayed, got to Rome, started to ask in this huge metropolis, has anybody seen Aurelius Augustinus, my son? Eventually, she gets a lead and says, to keep her off his tail, he had gone from Rome up to Milan. And so she again follows the trail of her son all the way to Milan. Eventually, she finds him. She starts practicing the faith there. St. Ambrose had converted in the meantime. He had been the prefect of Gaul, but then he settled the dispute for the election of the next bishop by becoming the next bishop, because there was a boy who started to cry out, Ambrose bishop, Ambrose bishop. The Holy Spirit seemed to come down upon him, and he became the bishop of Milan. He had to learn the faith. But he was so brilliant, he would become a doctor of the church and such a great preacher that St. Augustine soon came under his spell. And so Augustine converted, with much to his mom's delight. He was baptized. And then they were going to be going back to Africa. But Monica died before they were able to get there. She died in Ostia Antica. And Augustine was now really moved that he had wasted so much time appreciating his mom's faith and learning from her. And so she just said, don't worry so much about me. You've given me the greatest happiness any mom could ever have, to become a Catholic Christian. Just bury my body anywhere, but just keep praying for me after I've died. Have masses celebrated for me after I've died. Little did Augustine know at the time that he would become a priest who was able to celebrate those masses. And so after burying devoutly Monica in Ostia by the Roman port, he went back to Africa, founded a monastery, and eventually was ordained a priest. And then maybe we can talk a little bit further about how he was ordained a bishop later and all that he did in a very fruitful service to the church throughout all the centuries. But one of the big points of their story, Betsy, is Monica would never have become Saint Monica, unless she had to pray 17 years for her husband's conversion and 15 additional years for her son. Unless she had prayed with so many tears for 32 years, we would never be celebrating her on August 27th. Sometimes the Lord Jesus permits us to suffer and to pray for decades for those closest to us, because not only does he eventually want to give them the gift of conversion, but along the way, he sometimes wants to sanctify those people who love them through that persistence in prayer. And so that's one of the great lessons that Saint Monica bears in hope, in this Jubilee of Hope, for all of us who are praying for friends and family members, in the 5.5 billion or the 8 billion alive who don't really know Jesus Christ, who don't love Jesus, who don't serve him, who don't follow him, and who aren't spreading love of him.
I just wanted to read this one quote that really articulates everything that you just said from the Confessions. "But you sent down your help from above and rescued my soul from the depths of this darkness, because my mother, your faithful servant, wept to you for me, shedding more tears for my spiritual death than other mothers shed for the bodily death of a son." So powerful, isn't it, Monsignor?
He had the grace to perceive that his mom, though comparatively uneducated compared to all those he had studied with in rhetoric school, was one of the great giants who had ever lived. And her prayers were powerful. And, you know, for me, Betsy, like, we all have a spiritual mom in Mary who prays even more than Monica did. And if Monica's prayers were that powerful, and if the tears for the object of her husband, mother-in-law, and son wouldn't be lost, just think about the power of Mary's tears, along sometimes our own tears, inwardly and outwardly, for the conversion of those we care about. Just think about what it means that Mary, our mother, is praying for all her sons and daughters alongside our own petition. It gives us great hope in this Jubilee of Hope.
It really does. Can you say a word about his other seminal work, The City of God, and why that's such an important work in the history of the church?
So his two basic works are the Confessions, as you've just quoted from, in which he professes his great gratitude for God and all his mercy. He's got the two greatest quotes, I think, in all of hagiography, that our hearts are going to be restless until they've really rested in God. And late have I loved thee, O beauty ever ancient, beauty ever new, late have I loved thee, that he recognized that he had wasted so much of his life because he hadn't yet received the love of God. Even though God was all around him and within him, he was searching him on the outside. He was looking for God in his creation when God was flashing before him. He wasn't hearing his voice, but God penetrated his deafness. He was able to smell his fragrance and began to pant for more, and was touched by the Lord and longed for his peace. Like, the eloquence of that, even in translation, is just unbelievable. But then The City of God is his second great work, in which he was trying to talk about the role of Christians in the middle of the world and how we're supposed to live day by day. He said many people aren't living in a Christian context, and he was writing this as the barbarians were on their way to destroy North Africa, that in the midst of all of those who are trying to order everything to the city of this world, to make self-love in a selfish way the criterion for everything else, he said we have to live in the city of God and recalibrate all our loves to the love of God. And so not only is it a great political treatise, but it's also a great manifesto of how we're supposed to live as disciples and apostles in the middle of the world, always being in the world without being of the world, ordering our entire existence to the love of God, which is still reigning in the world. That's why the city of God is not just something in the heavenly Jerusalem, but it's something that we're supposed to be constructing and living in this world, trying to help others leave a worldliness behind, the city of this world, the earthly city, and join us in that kingdom Christ came to establish and that continues to exist. Can I talk a little bit about Augustine's conversions? Because I think it's one of the most important things. Do we have time, Betsy?
Will you please?
So Pope Benedict, as many of our listeners will remember, was likewise a spiritual son of St. Augustine. He had written one of his dissertations on Augustine, and he was one of the great experts in church history on St. Augustine's thought. And he said that St. Augustine had three conversions, not just his one from a lustful life. We all know that conversion. But he said St. Augustine had two greater conversions, that for all of us who are trying to please the Lord, we need to have those conversions too. He said this when he went to St. Augustine's tomb in Pavia, Italy in 2007 to pay this homage as the successor of St. Peter to the saint and spiritual father who had given him so much. The second conversion was to become a real person for others. You probably remember that St. Augustine had founded this monastery. He had written the rule by which everybody else was living. He was able to crank out these long treatises. But then he wanted to visit a friend in Hippo. And there in Hippo, he attended the mass in which the elderly bishop was very weakly preaching because he was so tired, for the people to pray for a coadjutor, somebody who could, as a priest and then as a bishop successor, carry on his ministry, but also from this point forward, because he was too weak, preach. And everybody looked around and there was Aurelius Augustinus, the greatest preacher in the Roman Empire. And they didn't want him leaving. And they wanted to constrain him in order to be the bishop. He didn't want to become the bishop, but he grasped that the Lord was actually giving him a new vocation there. And he quoted St. Paul from his second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 5, that if Christ has died for us, and we should no longer live for ourselves, but for him who died and rose again for us. And so Augustine grasped that he couldn't live for himself anymore, setting his own rule, doing things in which he was able to crank out theological terms, but that he had to become even more a person for others. And so he shifted totally. And all of Augustine's works thereafter came from his great homilies, which he was given to the people of Hippo, his letters that he was writing as the Bishop of Hippo. And the Lord created such a massive corpus of beautiful works that continue to nourish the church to this day because he became a person for others. Many of us, it's not just enough for us to be faithful to the Lord, to go to Eucharistic adoration every day. We need to recognize that Christ died for us so that we could love others as he has loved us. And St. Augustine teaches us what that conversion looks like. And his third conversion, he realized only late in life, Pope Benedict taught us, that at the very end, he looked over everything he had done as he was preparing to die. And particularly, he examined his treatise on the Beatitudes, which is the greatest treatise on the Beatitudes ever given in the history of the church. And he said, there are errors there. And the main error was, I was focused, Augustine said, too much on what we need to do to be poor in spirit. We need to do to be meek. We need to be a peacemaker. We need to hunger and thirst for holiness. We need to be willing to be persecuted in the other Beatitudes. He said, everything first comes from God's grace. And the third conversion was to recognize everything we do is already a participation in God's mercy. And so that rather than even just serving others by our own power, by our own will to do it in imitation of Christ, we need to open ourselves up to the way that God in his mercy wants to give us his help before we even think about doing it. And so he was writing that at the very end of his life so that we wouldn't have to wait to the end of our life to live by that third conversion, but to recognize that God mercifully wants to give us the grace truly to become saints, saints like Augustine, saints like Monica. And some of us are going to be brilliant like St. Augustine, like you are, Betsy. Others are going to be prayers like I am,
I doubt it.
St. Monica. But in between the two, we are able to find space for all of us to imitate them here on earth so that one day we too can enjoy their friendship in that ultimate city of God to which our Christian hope launches us.
Well, thank you for this really informative and grace-filled discussion of both of these people who are really dear to me and have been instrumental in so many people's conversions or in their persistence for especially their children. Thanks a lot,
Monsignor. Happy feast days, Betsy.
Thank you.